case for argument this morning is Bradich against the City of Chicago. Mr. Foley.
Morning, Judge Easterbrook. Good to see you again. Judge Sykes, good to see you. Judge Kane. Michael Foley representing the plaintiff appellant, Dolores Bradich. Your Honor, as a preliminary matter, there is a motion filed to strike the reply brief that the...
The motion has been denied.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Okay. This is a jail suicide case. Mike Bradich, or Melvin Bradich, was arrested on October 23rd, 1999. Undisputed evidence is that he was fine at the time that he was arrested, that the arresting officers used him as an informant, and that after they used him as an informant, he was incoherent, distraught, according to Defendant Simmons, and unable to cooperate in the booking process, according to Defendant Walker, the two lockup keepers. There were multiple violations of state and local policy in the care provided to Mr. Bradich during the 1 hour that he was in the cell, and he was dead within an hour and 15 minutes after he was celled. The theory of the case is that the detainee has a right to reasonable care, and that where the defendants are deliberately indifferent to that right, it violates due process. In this case, the plaintiff...
I don't understand that. The correct statement is where they're deliberately indifferent to a serious medical problem, there's a constitutional problem.
That's correct. That's correct.
Right, but it's not what you said, but you agree that that's the correct statement.
I agree with you, Your Honor. As a preliminary matter, the plaintiff filed a motion for summary judgment, which was partial, and that was based on the right to the prompt summoning of medical care under Revere versus Massachusetts. The undisputed evidence is that there was a 10-minute gap between the time that Melvin Bradich was discovered hanging and the time that the ambulance was dispatched. Under Tlomka versus Sorrell, 244 F3rd 628, that is a quintessential case of deliberate indifference. In addition, Ellis versus Washington County stands for the same proposition, that a 10-minute gap between discovery and summoning aid is a violation of the due process for the detainee. The basis, the factual basis on which we allege that there was a 10-minute gap is the official reports and pleadings of the defendants. There is no question that the discovery occurred at 6:15 p.m. on October 23rd. That's in the lockup keeper's log, exhibit number 5. The defendant's answers admit the 6:15 discovery, and the ambulance dispatch is at 6:25. According to the ambulance report, which is plaintiff's exhibit number 10. The court below erred when it held that because the 6:15 time was approximate, that necessarily meant that there was not a 10-minute gap. Your Honor, we have alluded to the testimony of Defendant Simmons, who said that the approximate could mean that he found him as early as 6 o'clock, which would not help the 10-minute gap problem. In this court, the defendants argue that the defendants spent their time cutting the ligature, despite the fact that Defendant Simmons testified that it took seconds to cut the ligature, and Defendant Hilbring testified that Defendant Walker was sent off to make the phone call before the ligature was cut.
They had to retrieve a knife, did they not?
That's correct. That's correct. But the estimate for time was given very expressly by Defendant Simmons, and nobody else has provided any estimate of time. When we asked him how long it took him to get the knife, he said seconds. When we asked him how long it took him to cut the ligature, he said seconds. When we asked him how long it took him to do all these things put together, he said seconds because we did a lot of these things at the same time. So given the only evidence about how long it took to cut the ligature is seconds, that's what this court is presented with. None of the defendants have presented any other estimate of the time. At the other end, the 625 ambulance dispatch time is undisputed. The court below, in error, found that Donna Parrott had testified that that time of dispatch was approximate, but really what she was testifying about was the time that she entered for the ambulance arriving at the lockup, not the time that the ambulance was dispatched. That was set by the dispatch center, according to Ms. Parrott, and there is no question about the accuracy of that time. Senior paramedic Russell Lane testified that, in his experience, ambulances were always dispatched shortly after a call was made, which means that although there are seconds between 6:15 and 6:25 that are accounted for, there are minutes, long minutes, perhaps as many as 8 or 9 minutes, that are not accounted for. The court below also engaged in some speculation about a gap between the time of the ambulance dispatch and the time of the phone call that was made. The problem with that speculation is, first of all, it is speculative, and that's improper on a motion for summary judgment. There is no evidence that there was such a gap that has been presented. We asked for that evidence from the city. None was provided. None was provided. And the city now asks you to fill in that gap. That's grossly inappropriate on a motion for summary judgment. Under Brown versus Hughes, an unexplained gap in time is prima facie evidence of the sort of deliberate indifference that Judge Easterbrook, you so ably defined. But if we were required to fill in that gap, perhaps in response to their motion for summary judgment, we can do that with the various things that the defendants did to alter the crime scene. It is admitted that the defendants altered the log, even though they were aware that this was a crime scene and no evidence was supposed to be altered. The City Department of Professional Standards accused defendant Simmons and Walker of not removing Melvin Bradich's shoelaces, which was a violation of policy. But when you see the crime scene photographs, there are the shoelaces removed, sitting in his shoes on the floor several feet away from the cell. The ligature was altered. The defendants...
Does any of this have to do with your constitutional claim?
Well, Your Honor, if we are looking at this as a motion for summary judgment from the city's standpoint, and it were our burden to show what happened during this gap period, this is what happened during the gap period, most likely. They cleaned up the crime scene. In addition, they altered the ligature. The ligature, according to the testimony of the defendants, was in the third tier of crossbars when Melvin Bradich attempted to hang himself, but the crime scene photographs show it in the second tier of crossbars from the floor. So did it fall out and fall back in? Seems doubtful. They cleaned up the television cards, the ashtrays, and the cups that were present in the lockup center during this time frame, because instead of doing their jobs, defendants Simmons and Walker were playing cards, watching television, and playing computer games. And most unusual of all, the ligature that Melvin Bradich is alleged to have hung himself with, which is his T-shirt, was placed on his body where it is noted in the autopsy report the next morning. So there was considerable activity, many things that these defendants had to take care of, and it makes a perverse kind of sense that given a choice between protecting themselves and their professional futures and taking care of Melvin Bradich, they chose to take care of themselves. The court below indicated that the 10-minute gap, even if proven, would not be deliberate indifference. But we think that is grossly inappropriate. I don't think any of us would want to live in a world where people could just look at you after you would stop breathing for 8, 9, 10 minutes and do nothing. That's not the standard that has been set in the Sixth Circuit in the Ellis and Plomka cases, and that's not the standard that should be recognized in this court. In addition, we have claims against the arresting officers. There is no question on appeal that the arresting officers used Melvin Bradich in a drug sting. He was arrested at 3 o'clock. There are 4 phone calls made from his house after 3 p.m., between 3:18 and 3:44 in the afternoon. 2 of the deponents testified that Mel tried to sell them Xanax over the phone that afternoon, and the other 2 calls were to a reputed cocaine dealer's telephone number. Apparently, he didn't get through. When arrested, Bradich, who was a heroin addict, was certainly intoxicated, but he was in a good mood. He was oriented to time and place. There is a lot of evidence to that effect, and the defendants cited that in their case. When turned over to the lockup keeper 2 hours later, Melvin Bradich was incoherent. He was distressed, and that's according to lockup keeper Ronald Simmons's report to the homicide detectives, and he was not capable of doing the simple physical and mental acts required of somebody who was going to be booked. In addition, Officer Harold Hanley told Mike Bradich that Mel couldn't walk and was being held up by the arresting officers as he was entering the station and that he wasn't right. Now, there's a question that's been raised regarding the admissibility of that statement. If I can give you a little bit of background on that. That statement was introduced in response to the defendant's motion for summary judgment. It was not objected to. The trial court determined that it would strike that evidence on the basis that it was not a prior inconsistent statement. We made a motion to reconsider because that was clear error, citing the Gaggio case, which stands for the proposition that a loss of memory can constitute a prior inconsistent statement. On appeal, we again presented the Gaggio case, which held prior inconsistent statements from lack of memory are admissible as such. The appeal response raised for the first time, the Rule 801D1 objection that the defendants are now making. And in response, we pointed out that Rule 801D2 would be applicable as an exception, and that therefore, in addition to coming in as impeachment, which it automatically should under the precedents that the city cited in their case, Dietrich in particular, it should also come in substantively.
Counsel, setting aside the evidentiary issue on this part of your claim, how is the evidence of Mr. Bradish's general state of incoherence and intoxication evidence that he presented a suicide risk?
Your Honor, under the decision in Payne by Hicks versus Churchage, this court has held that where an arrestee is engaged in increasingly bizarre or erratic behavior, that can constitute direct evidence of subjective knowledge on the part of the arresting officers or the
lawyer. I took my colleague's question to be one similar to mine. Is there any empirical evidence that people who are drunk or uncooperative are more likely to commit suicide than other people being arrested?
Your Honor, the Simmons versus Philadelphia case holds that.
I'm not asking about cases. I'm asking about data. Are there any data?
Your Honor, the
any
expert...
Any medical literature, any psychiatric literature.
I understand. The expert witness discovery in this case was stayed until after the motion for summary judgment.
You don't need expert witnesses to search the medical literature. Are there any data?
I'm unable to present you with any such data, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Foley. Ms. Pastor.
May it please the court. The plaintiff's primary theory of deliberate indifference in this case seems to be that upon discovering Mr. Bradich's body hanging in his cell, the lockup keepers did nothing for close to 10 minutes and then decided to cut him down and call an ambulance. There is, however, no evidence that supports this wholly implausible theory. This morning I will explain first why the plaintiff's theory regarding the speed with which the lockup keepers rescued Mr.
Bradich. The theory Mr. Foley was articulating today was that they cut him down quickly, spent 10 minutes trying to clean up the scene so that their violations of administrative rules wouldn't be noticed, in other words, in order to cover their behinds, and then called for medical help. Now, can that be rejected with sufficient certainty at the summary judgment stage?
Yes, it can, Your Honor. First, we commend Officer Simmons' testimony to the court, the entirety of the testimony, because from Officer Simmons' testimony...
Why do we have to believe any of these people?
Well, because there's no evidence that contradicts their account, Your Honor. For one
thing... Live testimony is not the only possible testimony. It's not the only possible source of evidence. I mean, your brief seems to assume that only affidavits are evidence, whereas one can draw inferences from the very fact that all this time passed, and indeed, as Mr. Foley stressed, that some tidying up does seem to have occurred.
Your Honor, there's certain...
Sometimes events speak more loudly than words. That's the point.
Well, Your Honor, one can certainly make inferences, as you suggest, and physical evidence is certainly relevant. In this case, the evidence that we do have is... First is, on one hand, the testimony of the officers, and that testimony indicates quite clearly that they spent the entire time from the discovery of Mr. Bradich's body
right.
to...
So
the
everything in your submission depends on the proposition that those affidavits must be believed.
That fact, Your Honor, and also the fact that the evidence that Mr. Foley alludes to, this physical evidence, this alleged...
Let me ask the question a different way. Who ultimately called the police? It wasn't any of these officers, was it? I mean, who ultimately called the ambulance?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. It was Detention Aide Walker.
Pardon?
Detention Aide Walker.
And did these affidavits say that she was in the cell helping to cut Bradich down?
He was in the cell. He was in the lockup at various points. He was the one who, I believe, fetched the knife from the kitchen and at some point was dispatched to call for emergency medical assistance.
There were at least three people, right, there?
Well, yes. Captain Hilbring arrived later. So initially there was only Officer Simmons and Detention Aide Walker. They were the two officers assigned to the lockup that day. Captain Hilbring arrived in the middle of the officers' attempts to rescue Mr. Bradich, in which they faced a difficult problem, Your Honor, because Mr. Bradich had managed to hang himself in such a way as to hamper the efforts to rescue him. He had tied the bars of the door shut so that the officers couldn't open the door in order to come in and rescue him.
Did he tie that in hanging himself?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. The ligature was tied in that way.
Moreover, the horizontal cross piece he was tied to.
I'm sorry?
Was the piece horizontal or vertical?
I believe it was a horizontal piece, Your Honor.
Where the cell door and that horizontal piece come together? I mean, that's the only way he could have kept the door from opening.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the testimony, is that the ligature was tied in such a way as to prevent the opening of the door. Of course, the ligature was, of course, taut against the bars.
Did these lockup keepers have CPR training?
The evidence in the record is a bit sketchy on that, Your Honor. It seems to me that they had training perhaps at the police academy.
A little louder, please.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor. Perhaps that they had some training when they were at the police academy, but nothing current.
I gather from their own affidavits that they didn't apply any CPR.
That's correct, Your Honor. There was testimony that they shook.
They yelled at Bradich and shook him, which are not standard CPR techniques. Was there any understanding under which it's prudent for somebody who has no idea what to do with a choking person to try to deal with that person rather than call somebody who does? Right, I can much more easily understand the idea that first you go and try to cut him down and deal with him if you know how to deal with him. But if you don't know how to deal with him, you call for somebody who does. It seems utterly bizarre to go to say what they did was they spent 10 minutes cutting him down and then yelling at him before they call for somebody who knows how to do CPR.
Your Honor, that may well be a more prudent cause of action. And what that describes is negligence.
Well,
that's not deliberate indifference.
No, I'm not. You're still not following my question. If it is bizarre, if the course of action they described is so bizarre as to be hard to believe, why isn't the right thing to do to say, and therefore we don't believe it? We think they were doing the 10 minutes doing something else.
Your Honor, the sequence of events described by these locker keepers is not so bizarre that we can't believe it. They were faced with a difficult situation, an emergency, urgent circumstances, and they reacted in a natural way. They attempted to cut Mr. Bradich down. This was, again, perhaps they should have called 911 first. Perhaps that would have been more prudent. But, again, that's evidence of negligence. It's not evidence of deliberate indifference.
Yeah, you're not addressing the question as I'm asking it. I mean, you're, again, just going back to the assumption that everything that's in their affidavits must be taken as gospel. The question I'm asking is, isn't the course of activity described in their affidavits so unusual that perhaps we should question whether they're telling the truth about what they did?
Well, it doesn't strike the city as that unusual, Your Honor. Moreover, what other evidence there is, to get back to this question of this physical evidence that Mr. Foley alluded to, that evidence is not evidence of deliberate indifference. What it may be evidence of is some sort of alteration of the crime scene, but, again, none of that goes to the ultimate question in this case. For example, if you take the issue about the alteration of the logbook, that occurred because they were in the process of writing the word normal when they saw Mr. Bradich on the video monitor hanging from the cell. They then ceased writing the word, went to rescue Mr. Bradich, came back later, and perhaps altered the book, and perhaps that was inappropriate. But it's not evidence of any nefarious cover-up. The evidence in this case is that the officers were endeavoring to rescue Mr. Bradich the entire time before they summoned help. Perhaps it wasn't the most, it wasn't the optimal way to do it, but that's not the standard here. Deliberate indifference requires requires knowing of the serious situation that detainee was in, which they did, and doing absolutely nothing, which is the opposite of what happened. They concentrated their efforts on rescuing him. In what was a difficult circumstance, the way the body was positioned made it very difficult to cut the ligature. They were unable to do it by hand. They had to run to the kitchen, procure a knife, attempt to cut it that way, while reaching through the bars to hold the body up to take the pressure off the ligature. So in these circumstances, the delay in summoning help is accounted for. It's understandable, and it's certainly not evidence of deliberate indifference, which, again, would require doing absolutely nothing.
What was the size of Mr. Bradich?
Your Honor, I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that.
The plaintiff suggests that the record does support an inference that for a substantial period of this 10-minute gap, the defendants, in fact, did nothing, because there is testimony in the record that supports the lapse of seconds in cutting him down. Is that a fair characterization of what the record says?
Well, Your Honor, Not exactly. The Officer Simmons testified that it took seconds to cut the ligature, the actual physical act of cutting the ligature. But Officer Simmons' testimony also describes this whole sequence of events, which clearly took some time. The going to the cell, the attempt to untie the ligature by hand while positioning the body, then the run to the kitchen for the knife, the return, cutting the ligature that way. So
what does the record say about how long those activities took?
Well,
according to the officer's testimony,
that they took approximately 10 minutes.
So they testified that entire lapse of time is explainable by the actions that they were taking.
Yes, Your Honor. I should correct myself. No one testified it took us 10 minutes to do X. What they did testify was this was how they filled the entire time before they were able to call 911. They weren't able to recall exactly how much time that was that passed, but that they were occupied the entire time with these efforts to free Mr. Bradage. And when one reads the account, it becomes quite clear that doing all these activities would take several minutes, particularly in light of the difficulty that this that Mr. Bradage posed in the way his body was positioned and other things.
Doesn't that require us to essentially resolve competing inferences in your favor, which we're not supposed to do?
That's correct, Your Honor, that you're not supposed to do that, but that's not what is required here, because there's no evidence on the other side that indicates that the officers were, in fact, not doing anything during that time. There's simply no evidence to suggest that. The physical evidence Mr. Foley alludes to does not indicate that. If you take, for example, this matter of the T-shirts, it's undisputed that T-shirts were used as a ligature. There's also evidence that Mr. Bradage was wearing a T-shirt at the autopsy. Perhaps, at best, that shows that at some point Mr. Bradage had access to three T-shirts. But even if one were to imagine that one of the officers put a T-shirt on the body, and when there's no evidence to support that, that still doesn't indicate any deliberate indifference. Doesn't indicate any attempt to even cover up misconduct, because it's not clear what misconduct that would cover up. There's likewise no evidence that any officer was deliberately indifferent to the risk of suicide posed by Mr. Bradage in this case. At worst, the evidence shows that Mr. Bradage was intoxicated and incoherent when the arresting officers brought him to the lockup. But the case law from this circuit and others is quite clear that whatever risk that creates, it is not the risk of suicide. In our common experience, people unfortunately can get drunk. And
common experience and judicial decisions are not a good way to answer a scientific question. What data do we have about what conditions actually pose risks of suicide?
Your Honor, there doesn't appear to be any medical data or scientific data in this record on that point.
There is an enormous volume of medical and scientific data on conditions of suicide, who commits suicide and when. We referred to this at some length in our opinion in Judsey Johnson. It just flabbergasts me that neither side has paid any attention to the medical literature on this question. If you want to figure out what happens in the real world, you don't consult judicial opinions.
Well, Your Honor, the point is well taken. It's the plaintiff's burden, of course, to introduce such evidence.
Your brief is full of statements about what conduces to suicide. They are utterly unsupported. Now, it may be true that the plaintiff has the burden, and he who has the burden loses when the record is empty. But I don't know on what basis you support the statements about what conduces to suicide.
Well, yes, as Your Honor points out,
very few people in this room have ever committed suicide. Right? This is not something on which we have personal experience. There's no reason to believe our personal experience, such as it is, would be reliable. And you certainly don't get it out of intuition.
Well, Your Honor, again, the point is well taken. Perhaps scientific evidence would have been useful in this case. What the judicial opinions, of course, are useful for in a case such as this goes to qualified immunity, because the case law does not give any indication that intoxication and incoherence alone are sufficient to put officers on notice, to impute officers with notice of a substantial risk of suicide, such that ignoring it would constitute deliberate indifference, so that in this case, at a minimum, these officers were entitled to qualified immunity because there was no indication that Mr. Bradage's state would lead him to harm himself. If there are no further questions, we'd simply ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Pastor. The case is taken under advisement.